Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom. I am Josh Beiser, and tonight we got a great cast. This is going to be actually part two of a discussion that we started, I think it's been at least a year, maybe a little bit more since then. But my returning guest tonight, he is a game designer, author, consultant, and a teacher. He has been writing and talking about the game industry for over two decades at this point. You probably know him for his No Twinkie database that has appeared on Gamasutra and his own site. Please welcome back to the podcast, Ernest Adams.
Thank you very much for having me, Josh.
It's a pleasure to have you back, Ernest. I know we were going to have our part two very quickly after our last one, but I know you got very busy very fast.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in my life. I'm a part-time university professor, and the rest of the time I have to be chasing the dollar and looking for other work and writing and so on. So yes, I'm sorry I wasn't able to come back any sooner. Anyway.
Not a problem. So the last time we had you on, we talked about your background. We started talking a little bit about game design and what makes a good or bad game. And I think we should probably, touch on that, or at least maybe wrap up a little bit more of our thoughts on that before we go to new topics. So, from our last podcast, we started talking about what makes a good game, and you were talking about how the elements would harmonize. Everything would, you know, work together, they're meshed right, didn't feel like there was an element that was out of it. And I wanted to expand on that, or at least talking a little bit more about great game design, because as I mentioned a few minutes ago, you, of course, have written the No Twinkie database, which is a collection of all the annoying or bad mechanics or design decisions that you've seen developers make over the last, I think at this point, it's probably going to be close to two decades since you started, right?
Yes. It was 1997 that I started writing about games, although I had actually been in the industry for several more years before that. So, yes, I have collected a very long list of game design errors.
I guess the first question I want to ask you, in terms of great game design, as I said a second ago, last time you mentioned about how elements would harmonize with each other. From your own experience, are there any game developers or games you've played that are standout examples of that philosophy of just game design harmony?
I would say that just about everything Nintendo makes, actually, particularly Shigeru Miyamoto, qualifies, because they just never put a foot wrong. Everything that is in their games very much feels like it belongs to their games. It's a single, unified, coherent universe. And so that's a perfect example of the kind of harmony that I'm talking about. Yeah. You know, it never gets inappropriately gory, or it never gets, you know, more scary than you would want for a game that's largely aimed at children, and so on. So, you know, if you look at things like Ocarina of Time or, you know, some of the Mario games, they're just perfect examples of doing everything right and attending to all the little details. Now, this is not to say that sometimes they're not very hard or sometimes they're not buggy. Super Mario Sunshine, for example, was sort of a notorious game. But nevertheless, the artwork, the music, you know, the kinds of things you're trying to accomplish and so on, all fit together.
And that's something that we hear a lot from game developers that we've talked to on the podcast, is how a lot of people really do appreciate Nintendo's game design, and it has been really their strongest element for over, at this point, it's been just about three decades, really. And it's one, I think that's a really weird thing about Nintendo, because we hear a lot of people complain or criticize Nintendo for the fact that they typically tend to just use, or I'm sorry, make use of their same franchises. Of course, we mentioned Mario, Zelda. We can see all the different Mario games and those types of things that come out year after year. And it may be a fair criticism that they don't explore completely new franchises. But as you said, Ernest, when they get down into the game development side of things, they really stick the landing, in a manner of speaking, in terms of getting everything they want in the game and making it the best game possible from a mechanic point of view.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree. And, you know, yes, it's true that Nintendo does not show that much innovation in their internal development. Mm-hmm. Now, there's all sorts of games for Nintendo devices that do show all kinds of innovation. But I think this is actually a clever move on Nintendo's part, because what that means is that they are letting external developers take the risk of bringing out a new franchise, whereas they are continuing to exploit franchises that they know work and make money. So, you know, in, from a business standpoint, that actually makes a great deal of sense, as long as they don't make a mistake and do something with their franchise that harms it, yes. and they're very careful not to, then they win. People, you know, continue to play Mario and continue to play Zelda games, and the other developers take the risk on developing new franchises, and sometimes they're successful and sometimes they're not.
Mm-hmm. Now, speaking about Nintendo, and probably one of the big changes that has happened between when we last spoke and today, would have to be Nintendo's entry into the Toys to Life genre, which was originally really balloon thanks to Spyro Skylanders. Now we have Disney Infinity. There was just recently there's going to be a Lego version of this soon. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, Ernest, what do you think about this Toys to Life genre? How it has really taken off over the last, I think it's been like three or four years, I think, but I'm not 100% sure on that.
To be honest, I haven't really followed the Toys to Life genre in its recent incarnation, so I can't speak to how that is going at the moment. But I am kind of amused to hear that it's happening, because I was actually involved in a project to try and get that off the ground as far back as about 1991. I was working for a little company called Interactive Productions, and we had an idea of trying to create figurines, action figures that you could play with that would include flash memory or bubble memory, as it was at the time, that would allow people to take games with the data inside their character and take the character to other children's houses and play on their devices and so on. It never went anywhere because we never got any funding. But it's interesting to see that this has now come back around and somebody's making a go of it. So I wish them luck. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, and they've definitely been making some money off it. The Skylander series has become immensely popular. Nintendo had a field day over the last year with scarcity and raising the value of their amiibos. And I am just sitting in awe at what's going to happen with the Lego amiibos, considering the popularity of like the Lego movie and just the revitalization of that brand. But
yeah, it's a fairly obvious thing to do. You know, when you think about it, it's natural that we have USB drives that you can store game data on. We have action figures, so it makes a lot of sense to just put the data inside an action figure and let people carry it around with them. And of course, when you have valuable franchises, you know, like for example Mario or Bowser or Pokemon characters that you can carry with you, then you know, that's a very natural sort of thing to do. When we were trying to do it all that way in the past, well, the company I was at did not have any valuable franchises. So it really needed something like Mario or Lego to help it take off. And yes, I expect it to be worth a fortune.
Definitely. Now, getting back to just overall game design and game development, one other question I really wanted to ask you, Ernest, about your thoughts on good and bad game design, is what is your opinion of games that are meant to be extremely hard or very difficult on that end? Now, you mentioned Nintendo as a great example of a game that can be aimed at multiple skill groups, multiple ages. But for games that are definitely aimed on the hardcore end of the pool, I'm talking stuff like the Demon's Souls series, the roguelike genre, especially more on the hardcore end, like when we see games where you're meant to replay this game over and over again just due to its sheer difficulty, do you consider these to be great examples of game development, or do you think that they basically are like in a different category that we can't group them the same way as titles like Nintendo with their harmony?
Well, they're aimed at a different audience. Mm-hmm. I feel as if they borrow from the old traditional arcade model, where it was necessary to kill the player at regular intervals in order to get them to put in coins. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we needed to make sure that they died every 2.5 minutes on average. Mm-hmm. And that was the way that the arcade industry's business model worked. And, you know, people got very used to it, and a lot of people felt that that's what video games should be like and so on. But, of course, the reality is that, you know, with consoles and with PCs and so on, there isn't any need to make money that way in particular. So I would say that, you know, it's not wrong, it's not right, it's just aimed at a particular market. But I would warn people who are interested in doing that, that it is necessarily a small market. Mm-hmm. You know, the number of people who really have the kind of time that is necessary to dedicate to beating Ninja Gaiden is a relatively small number of people. And, you know, and for the people who want to make such games and contact with those kinds of players, then more power to them. But, you know, the industry has moved on beyond that model, and we're interested in trying to reach as many people as we can and make games playable by a very wide number of people. Mm-hmm. So those games are not going to go away, but they are no longer the mainstream, and they will never again be the mainstream.
Yeah. Definitely a good point about that, Ernest. I mean, I also grew up during the arcade era, and I remember having to play those games where you're just throwing quarters at it until you either win or you run out of money. And we really have seen, in terms of the mainstream version or mainstream part of the industry, has really grown to produce more about these unique experiences rather than trying to just overwhelm the player or force them to spend more money. Although we could say that some of that has found its way into the mobile and social markets lately, with a lot of developers trying to just hit the player over their head with microtransactions or try to use a gaming or gambling mechanics and systems to coerce people to keep spending money.
Right. That works a little bit differently, however. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, those kinds of games don't simply provide a game that is very hard. Mm-hmm. What they do is they actually provide a game that is initially quite easy.
Yeah.
And they get you going along level after level, doing pretty well and thinking you're doing well. And then they incorporate what they call in the industry a stopping level. Mm-hmm. And that level is intentionally so hard that the only way to get around it, unless you're willing to just spend incredible amounts of time, is to pay money. So rather than just be incredibly difficult for the sake of it, you know, they give you a nice, steady, smooth progression, and then suddenly stop you with an incredibly difficult level and force you to pay money that way. Mm-hmm. It's a slightly different mindset, and of course, it's related to trying to get people sort of sucked in and committed to it, whereas that's not the way Ninja Gaiden works.
Yeah. Now, another part of game development that I do want to just touch briefly on about your opinion is one of the more unusual genres that we've seen sort of blow up, or I wouldn't say blow up, but has pretty much gotten a small but rabid fan base, and that is the clicker genre. I know game developer Ian, can't pronounce his last name, Bogost, who made the game Cow Clicker as a joke, and then it took off surprisingly. Now we're seeing other developers try this. Like, there's Cookie Clicker, so many games with the word clicker in the genre, and it's something that myself and several of my friends, we get sucked into for a short burst of time, and then we just get bored of it completely. But from a game designer point of view, what do you think about how this thing started out as a joke, and now there's people legitimately trying to make a profit or make a game out of it?
Well, my feeling is that it's not very interesting as an aesthetic exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
I think of video games as an art form, and they provide entertainment. And this is, in fact, one way that you can provide entertainment is by collecting little widgets that you get for clicking. And, you know, Cow Clicker was meant to be a satire of this.
Mm-hmm.
And on games, it was a satire of games like Mafia Wars, for example, where all you do is simply click things and you collect up points of one kind and another, and then you run out of some valuable resource and you have to wait and then come back later. Or, of course, you can pay cash and play more immediately. And it's appealing to a sort of a little area in the brain that has to do with the pleasure of collecting things. and seeing tasks completed. So in Mafia Wars, you know, you see dozens and dozens of power bars that are slowly filling up as you click on things. And when one fills up, then you get some little reward, and you feel a kind of a pleasurable sensation that something has been completed and so on. It's not tremendously imaginative. I mean, the cleverness in it involves trying to find some kind of activity that you can overlay on it as a skin that gives it a little life. So Mafia Wars is about, you know, being a mafiosi. But they're all other than that, they're all largely the same. So, you know, and frankly, the game Game of War, which you may have heard of, that's gotten enormous amounts of attention recently, largely because of the advertising and the involvement of Kate Upton, is, it turns out, not really a real-time strategy game at all. Mm-hmm. It's actually a clicker underneath. So, you know, people are doing that because they get the reward of it. But speaking as a game designer, I don't condemn it, but I don't think it's very interesting. It's kind of like selling really low-grade ice cream at the beach. Yeah. You know? There are people who are going to want it, and it's, you know, an opportunity, but it's not high cuisine, so to speak.
Yeah. Okay. I think, we could sit here and talk for the next 2-3 hours on various game design and game development related questions, but I know you're busy today, and we have several other topics to get to, so I have just, I think, two more general game design let's just stick with game design questions for you right now, and then we'll move on to our next topic.
Mm-hmm.
The first question that I want to ask you about, Ernest, one of the things that we've been talking with a lot of other developers about, and just getting their feeling for the market, has been talking about whether or not the game industry is heading for any kind of quote-unquote crash. A few months ago, I spoke with Thorsten Rosser, who gave the speech at Casual Connect Europe, where he was basically condemning social and mobile games for their exploitative practices, and for not trying to create experience, but just trying to create what would be considered like a gambling machine, essentially. And we spoke about how he felt the mobile market was heading towards an industry crash, just not being sustainable. And one of the things that we've heard developers talk about for the last few years is that the AAA industry would be heading for some kind of crash, with major developers spending way too much money on games and not getting the ROI, or return on investment, back from them. So my question for you, Ernest, is, from your perspective, do you think there's any threat or any worry of a part of our industry crashing? Or do you think those claims may be somewhat unfounded, at least for right now?
I think that the mobile game industry is perhaps due for a bit of a shakeout. Mm-hmm. I won't say a crash. You know, everybody, of course, remembers or they've heard about the crash of 1983.
Yeah.
But the crash of 1983 was caused by something fairly specific, and it happened at a time when the industry was far, far smaller.
Yeah.
The conditions that occurred in the crash of 1983 had to do with there being far too many games of a low quality, and people just, you know, quit buying them for a while. And so they didn't go ahead and because there were only a few companies making games at the time, the fact that people stopped buying them did a great deal of damage. The difference today is, of course, there are vastly many more companies making games, and I don't think we're going to see a crash of that nature, simply because there are so many different sorts of companies in the market and so many people playing them. So it's not going to be like 1983. However, we have certainly seen a great deal of kind of over-enthusiasm for the possibilities of the market. And as a result, you've seen things like the enormous stratospheric rise of Zynga, which at one point its market cap value was in fact greater than that of Electronic Arts.
Yeah.
It has now gone back down because, in fact, the growth rate of mobile games was not, and other kinds of games that Zynga made, was not sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
And that is related to what happened in the crash of 1983, because the growth rate of Atari games also was not sustainable. And they were predicting growth, that would continue to go on, and it never does. It never does. It always mm-hmm. settles down. You know, it continues to grow, but it settles down, and so you don't get that kind of rocket-like behavior forever. You can't.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen, I think, is that certain mobile game companies are going to have to scale back their expectations. They're going to have to learn to live a little bit more within their means. Zynga has sadly had that happen to them, and they've had to, you know, make some big layoffs and so on. And so rather than crash in the sense of companies going entirely out of business, we're seeing a downscaling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I think that is a natural phenomenon when you have companies that have overextended their capabilities based on an assumption that those kinds of revenues are going to be available forever. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the AAA companies are concerned, that's a somewhat different question. If you look at Electronic Arts' revenue sources over the last 3 or 4 years, you know, the number that have come from retail sales has just gone down and down and down. The number that have come from mobile and online sales has gone up and up and up. And in fact, their overall growth has continued. So in fact, Electronic Arts is doing very well. Their stock price has tripled in the last few months. You know, as their growth continues, they are rather intelligently refocusing their efforts on the areas that are going to make the money. Companies that are 100% committed to AAA and don't know any other way to make money are going to be in trouble. You know, they simply cannot continue to support these very, very large amounts of money that they spend on their projects with a shrinking population of AAA players. So I don't think AAA is going to crash either. I think that companies that are AAA only are going to struggle. And you know, that is going to be a shrinking percentage of the whole thing. You know, if I had any stock in bricks and mortar game stores, I would get out of it. Now we'll still continue to sell games at retail in places like Walmart, particularly where games are aimed at a younger audience. They're viewed as toys and so on. That continues to work, but the specialist game store, I believe, is in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think we are seeing that with a lot of the major big box stores like GameStop, Best Buy, just really trying to reinvent themselves in today's era. Because again, the game industry as a whole has really taken to digital distribution. It's been paramount in indie development as a way of getting these games in front of people. We could spend 10, 20 minutes just on Steam alone and all the contributions it's done to the game industry since it came out in 2004. But
sure,
it's definitely going to be, I think, as you said, I think we will probably see some kind of shakeup. Some of the major players, I know people like to joke that, you know, Nintendo's always has one foot in the grave or they're going to fail, but I don't see Nintendo or some of like the more stable major developers falling out. But as you said, I think we'll probably see something change in terms of maybe just like the formulation or the philosophy of AAA development. We're halfway done this decade, so really will be interesting to see where we are at in the next 5 years.
Yeah, and there are certain areas of AAA that I think are going to continue to go along very nicely. You know, the Madden NFL footballs and the Need for Speeds and the Halos and those kinds of games where there's a very solid franchise. People know what to expect from it. You know, they look forward to the upgrades and, of course, the continuing things from Nintendo. Those are less likely to run into trouble than when people make very large, very expensive AAA games that are not proven franchises. So that's another reason for thinking that AAA is not going to die, because there are the Marios and the Maddens. But, you know, it still means that you have to be cautious about AAA. And of course, they have been increasingly cautious because the big game publishers simply aren't making as many AAA games as they used to.
Yeah. All right. And my last question for you regarding game design, at least for this cast in earnest, is, as we talked about, one thing that you've ran for over the last 2 decades would be the No Twinkie database. As we said, it's a collection of bad design elements or mechanics that you see game developers make.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to sort of be like a counterpoint and maybe tie up this section of our podcast, are there any like great examples of either game design philosophy or mechanics that have taken root over the last decade that you would turn to as, you know, a example of, hey, this is something that good job game industry, you've done something really well on?
I think in the last decade or so, our big success has been embracing the casual market. Mm-hmm. You know, there actually have always been small handheld games aimed at people, and you know, the success of things like the Game Boy and so on. That was limited simply because of the weakness of the hardware, and the explosion in indie games has, you know, been made possible by the availability of smartphones. Because the trouble with the Game Boy is, of course, all it does is play games. And, you know, there are not that many adults who want to carry around a device that only plays games. But they're certainly willing to carry around a smartphone. And the fact that you can sell them a game on that smartphone makes it very popular. So it's not a mechanic. It's really a kind of a distribution medium. But, you know, and smartphones have a touchscreen, and that's something that we never used to pay any attention to in the past. But the touchscreen is something that we have adopted, and we've learned how to do it and use it well and figure out appropriate ways to build games that work with that. You know, there's some interesting challenges associated with touchscreens because your hand is in front of part of the output device. Mm-hmm. So, you know, your hand is in fact blocking part of what it is that you're trying to see. So game design has faced the challenge of how do you ensure that the player is able to play the game efficiently, even though their hand is covering up part of the screen. So that's one of the things that I think we've done particularly well is adapt to the touchscreen, adapt to mobile gaming. And make a huge success of it, and I'm very pleased about that. Other things that we've done in the last little while, you know, the move from the subscription based model to the free to play model for MMOGs has meant that people sort of pay what they want, and things like Dungeons and Dragons Online, for example, when they went free to play, they suddenly started making five times as much revenue as when they were having subscription charges. And you know, that's very clever indeed. Tell people you can play the game for free and somehow manage to make five times as much money as you did before. So we've gotten quite good at providing people with entertainment and getting money from them in a way that does not, you know, require them to fork out a lot up front. So I think that has been a major success as well. As far as kind of actual game design itself in terms of the nature of the gameplay and so on, I haven't seen a lot of big changes. You know, we haven't seen any huge leaps in AI. We haven't seen the ability to, you know, speak English to games particularly successfully and those kinds of things that are, you know, that are really hard. But we have managed to adapt very well to the challenges that face us in the new era and the growth. And one of the things that has helped us enormously in all of this is the development of middleware. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the old days, you had to write all your own graphics drivers. And then Windows came along, and at least they separated you from that. But you still had to write your own rendering engine. And then we began to get, you know, hardware acceleration and rendering engines and so on. And now we have one-stop shopping with something like Unity that provides you with all kinds of things. You know, you can have pathfinding, you can have dialogue engines, you can have you know, variable cameras and all kinds of stuff in something like Unity particle effect systems and so on. I'm not just pushing Unity, but it's an example of one of the things that has made game development so vastly much easier for us and that has contributed to this enormous explosion of games that are available. And I'm really happy to see it. I mean, you know, as an old school coder, in a way, of course, we all remember the days when we coded on the bare metal and we had to count clock cycles on our fingers and that kind of thing. But frankly, you know, I wouldn't want to go back to that any more than I would want to go back and drive a Model T. I may feel like a badass that I used to drive a Model T, but you know, it's not what I want in my driveway now.
Yeah. All right. Great point to end on for this topic, Ernest. So Let's move on. I know we only have a few more minutes, so there is definitely one topic that I do want to touch on with you, Ernest, and that is something that we've been seeing or we've been hearing a lot of things about over the last year is really getting going when we last spoke a few months ago, and that is discussing more about the video game industry becoming more inclusive, specifically with getting women interested in game development industry. There's, of course, been the, I guess, disturbing issue of Gamergate that has taken root. I think at this point of this recording, it has, I think, at least from what I've been hearing, it has somewhat died down, but it still seems to be lingering in a sense.
Right. Well, let's address a couple of different issues separately here. First, the question of trying to get women into the game industry. This has been a problem for a long time. Mm-hmm. There were a number of women in the game industry in its early days. There were not very many, but there were a number of, you know, fairly famous ones, people like Roberta Williams, for example, that we, you know, we all remember. But it has been an uphill battle generally, partly because of a perception that has grown, unfortunately, in computer science departments that this is a male field. Mm-hmm. Partly because it is not a particularly financially stable business to be in. And women are already behind the eight ball when looking for jobs just because of their gender anyway. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be, and I'm, you know, not speaking for all of them, but they tend to be a bit more conservative and a bit more cautious about their career choices. And, you know, if you are a woman who is, a very skilled coder and you have the opportunity to make a bunch of money in the defense or the banking industry, or you have the opportunity to make less money and, you know, have it be really quite uncertain whether you'll keep your job for long in the game industry, you know, a woman may be somewhat more inclined to go for the steady, reliable paycheck. And, you know, nobody can really blame them for that. So that is one consideration. You know, there has also been, unfortunately, the growth of a sort of meme or a culture of game development, which has largely been promoted by the fact that we have the internet now, and there's a lot of online forums of the programmer and this kind of chest beating macho competition and so on, and this view that the process of programming software is somehow a competition that needs to be won and so on. And that's not really the way a lot of women like to work. They're not particularly interested in showing that they are better than somebody else or, you know, trying to demonstrate that they're a superior programmer to other people. So where you find that, you find women discouraged from getting involved because that's simply not the style in which they like to work. Now, in my opinion, it's a bad thing for games anyway because game development is a highly cooperative activity. It requires a team to be on the same page, you know, working very hard together and very closely together, and any kind of arrogance or prima donna behavior, you might be able to get away with that in very small three-person indie teams, but that does not work in larger scale game development. So that hasn't helped either. And, you know, we continue to do outreach of various sorts, you know, trying to get little girls involved in STEM and provide women like the Women in Games International organization. WIGI does outreach to women who are in the industry, and it tries to encourage more women to get into the industry and so on. And that's all to the good because it provides us with a perspective and a viewpoint on life, on gameplay, on players, and so on that we simply don't have if we're all male teams. So we have an uphill battle and we have people who are fighting hard. And that's, you know, something that we simply continue to face. And I don't think we will be reaching parity, 50-50, you know, men and women in the game industry for a long time. Mm-hmm. While the game industry remains an unstable place to have a career. So, and now Gamergate and related thing sort of phenomena are kind of a different issue. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that has occurred since the growth of the internet that simply did not happen before is that it is now very easy for extremists to find each other. You know, back in the old days, before there was any internet, You know, if the Ku Klux Klan wanted to get together, they had to physically get together in one place. Mm-hmm. And it was rather difficult for them to get in touch with each other kind of long distance. They didn't know who they were and so on. No newspaper would allow them to, you know, print the kind of things that they believe in a public forum like that. So it was quite difficult for extremists to gather en masse. Well, the internet has made it possible, you know, for good and for ill, for groups of people to join together and, you know, like-minded people who have a particular point of view very, very easily indeed. And this includes some very, very nasty people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Gamergate crowd is composed of a variety of different kinds of people. Some of them are people who are essentially very reactionary about games. They don't want games to change from what they are. They're offended by the idea that we should try to seek out new markets and look for additional players and, you know, try to make games for women and games for, you know, Saudi Arabians and, you know, mm-hmm. You know, games for other markets. And they feel as if, because they are very dedicated hobbyists, that this is somehow their medium. And so they are very, very hostile to any effort to change what it is. And as far as I'm concerned, that's tough. it's not their medium. It's our medium. You know, mm-hmm. we're the ones who actually build the games. You know, they're the ones who buy them. They're the ones who pay for them. And if they don't like them, they're welcome to boycott them. But the fact is, there are untapped markets out there. We're not going to just leave money on the table simply because they don't like it. So, you have this kind of reactionary group that feels entitled to demand that games only be made for them and no one else. And, you know, from a business standpoint, that's completely absurd. Mm-hmm. Then you also have people who are just, you know, nasty, misogynist, sexist, obnoxious, vile human beings who, anytime a woman sticks her head above the parapet for any reason, takes pot shots at her. And, you know, there's still enormous double standards. You know, the sexual behavior of men is tolerated in ways that the identical sexual behavior in women receives condemnation. You know, that's a classic throughout history and so on. And most of these people are just immature and obnoxious. But some of them are in fact actually dangerous and they are criminals. You know, they are engaging mm-hmm. in terroristic threatening. And this does not only discourage women from getting into the game industry, but it discourages the women who are in the game industry from speaking out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I know professional colleagues of mine who have been silenced, you know, who have yeah. chosen not to say anything about these issues simply because they are, or their children are, believe it or not, physically endangered by some of these people. And fortunately, the tide has turned as far as the mass media are concerned. Yeah. So it has now become clear that, you know, what the nature of this kind of activity is, and that it is intended at suppressing women's voices. It is intended at driving women out of the industry and driving them out of their homes. And the mass media has become aware of that and has begun to condemn this kind of behavior. It will never go away entirely because they will always find a place to gather together on the internet. However, as we go on, I think they will become increasingly irrelevant, and they're already increasingly irrelevant as it is, but they will cease to be significant to us. But it has been a fight, and it will remain a fight.
Yeah.
I have talked now for about 5 minutes straight. I'm sorry for the length of that. No, right. I hope you can manage with that.
That is fine. Yeah, and definitely a lot of good points in there, Ernest. And with some of the forums that I visit, some of the people I know, I've also heard similar stories of women being either terrorized, scared, or both from these people. And I think you are correct that the tide is beginning to turn, not just in the fact that, as you said earlier in the game design section, how much the rise of casual and social game have really ballooned our audience, but also in terms of just the evolution of game development and the medium itself, that we are seeing people trying to make things beyond just a very niche audience. And some of our most successful games have been those that have managed to deliver a great experience while still being inclusive to multiple people, skills, genders, etc. Now, with like the whole Gamergate thing as it is, I think, as you said, that it's definitely been something that's been rooted in our industry for since probably like the 90s, maybe even earlier than that, in terms of the perception of women, in terms of character design. As you said, the quote-unquote bro-grammar type mentality has been a part of things as well. I guess from my own experience, I think, as you said, it is a good point that there will still be an audience for these types of games, for this type of mentality, but it is going to be vastly, vastly overshadowed by people who want more inclusive games, for people who are looking at things from the game industry as an art form, or developing these unique experiences, like games like Gone Home, Dear Esther, and even as we said with like Nintendo, and making very polished, very great design games that are aimed for a vast majority of people.
Well, absolutely. You know, and let's talk about some actual numbers here. Mm-hmm. There are hundreds of millions of gamers in the world. Yeah. There may be as many as a billion gamers in the world. You know, I mean, when you take all across the entire world, the number of people who play video games, you know, that is a truly colossal number of people. The number of people who are causing these problems on Gamergate is in the low thousands, mm-hmm. you know. Now, it's true that 1,000 people can, you know, harass a woman and frighten a woman and, you know, be extremely obnoxious and unpleasant. But in the larger scale of things, they are utterly irrelevant financially. You know, there is no point whatsoever in kowtowing to these people's demands when they represent only a few thousand gamers. You know, mm-hmm. They believe themselves to represent all gamers. They absolutely do not. Yeah. And, you know, we have people to build games for. We have products to sell all over the world for all kinds of people. Mm-hmm. And so their estimation of their importance is wildly inflated. Yeah. And anybody who gives them any additional thought or attention is wasting their time.
And speaking about numbers, I just want to ask you one thing, Ernest. One of the things I keep hearing that people have been arguing about is whether or not the video game industry, in terms of an audience, is at the point of being 50-50 split between men and women playing games. I remember seeing one number that's saying that was like 41% women. Someone else was saying it's 52%. Has there been any conclusive data on what the audience is in terms of gender-wise?
Not worldwide, okay. But there have been studies in particular locations. Now, in the United States, it's certainly getting closer to 50-50. I don't know exactly what those numbers are. It's certainly in the high 40s. I think about 45% or maybe a little more female players in Britain. In the United Kingdom, in fact, there are more women playing than men now.
Okay.
It's actually over 50% female players. Now, you know, the sort of Gamergate type people will say, oh, those aren't real games. Those aren't real gamers. It doesn't count, and so on, and look for excuses to discount this. But the fact is, if we are making money off you, you're a gamer. I don't care what shape your genitals are. If you got cash, you know, I'm happy to take it from you. So, It is approaching 50%, and in fact, it's even gone over 50% in the United Kingdom. So mm-hmm. It is extremely foolish for a company to write off, you know, a potentially 50% of its market, unnecessarily. Now, there are particular genres that are, you know, tend to appeal more to men. Mm-hmm. If you're making a hardcore driving game where you drive around like a maniac and smash things up, that does tend to appeal more to men than to women. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason that you should change that mm-hmm. necessarily. But you have to be aware that, you know, your market is not as large as it might otherwise be. Mm-hmm. You know, by comparison to something like Mario or Pokemon or something like that, that, you know, has a very cross-gender appeal. So,
yeah. And again, I think that goes back, as we said, that that these markets aren't going to go away. I don't think there's going to be a point where bro shooter, hardcore, violent game is going to disappear completely. But as you said, it's just going to really be overshadowed by the games that are more inclusive, that lend themselves to a larger audience.
Yeah, it's just a shrinking percentage of the total. But you know, it's absolutely not going to go away. And it's going to continue to grow, for that matter. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it's not going to grow as fast as the rest of the industry does.
Mm-hmm. Now, one part of the Gamergate thing, and this isn't me trying to say the quote-unquote there's two sides argument, but one thing that they keep touting as their rallying cry is ethics in game journalism. And obviously, you and I, we both know that, at least from the Gamergate point of view, that is somewhat bull. But in terms of that kind of thing that people keep saying that there's an ethical issue with game journalism and stuff like that, what are your thoughts on that? Is that just BS, or is there some legitimacy, at least from that point of view, not, you know, trying to lump anything about their attacks on women into that kind of conversation?
Right. Right. Well, yeah. You know, the ethics in game journalism, as far as Gamergate is concerned, is largely a smokescreen, which is intended to justify their other behavior. But leaving that aside and looking at the gaming press itself generally, the gaming press has not changed substantially since the 1980s. Now, you know, people in the 1980s and the 1990s were also complaining about game journalism at the time. They just weren't, you know, threatening to rape anybody as they did it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the reality is this is an enthusiast press. You know, this is like Car and Driver or Field and Stream.
Yeah.
Okay, and you're not going to get Car and Driver trashing BMW or Mercedes or General Motors because their advertising would dry up. And, you know, and they would disappear. So all enthusiast presses are necessarily, I won't use the word corrupt, but I will say they are necessarily beholden to their advertisers, and they have to take a very positive view of everything that, you know, goes on in the industry that they are covering. Mm-hmm. And that is no more true of games than it is true of things like Car and Driver, or for that matter, Cosmopolitan. You know, you're not going to see women's magazines suddenly start trashing the makeup companies. You know, the Revlon and Maybelline and so on. You know, they're not going to do that. And yes, you know, it is a fact that the gaming press is necessarily, you know, in bed with the game publishers. And that's the breaks, you know, deal with it. As far as I'm concerned, when you buy a gaming magazine, when you go to a gaming website and so on, if you are expecting hardcore investigative journalism, you are in the wrong place. You know, go read the New York Times. You know, it is a legitimate observation, but it is a pointless thing to make a big fuss about, because that is simply the nature of any enthusiast press.
Yeah.
And my response is, grow up, don't be so naive, get over it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want hardcore investigative journalism, find a different outlet. You will not find it in the enthusiast press.
Mm-hmm. And bring this back to Gamergate, I think, obviously, as we said, in terms of trying to put that or overlap in the Gamergate thing, it really is just a smokescreen to what they've been doing and really to how the whole thing really started. It seems like it's been so long now since we first started hearing about it.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's, you know, if you actually follow Gamergate tweets on Twitter, they have very, very little to do with trying to reform the press.
Yeah.
You know, their effort to persuade Intel to drop their advertising from Gamasutra, for example, on grounds that Gamasutra is somehow mean to gamers, backfired colossally, because Intel did drop its advertising on Gamasutra for all of about a month. Mm-hmm. And then they realized that they had been tricked.
Yeah.
And they suddenly put some staggering amount of money, I think $20 million. I don't remember the exact amount. Mm-hmm. Anyway, some absolutely gigantic amount of money into improving diversity and encouraging women to get into gaming and high-tech fields. So their efforts to, in fact, drive women out had absolutely the opposite effect. Intel actually began to support diversity in the field, which is wonderful. We're completely delighted. Mm-hmm. So yeah, as far as I'm concerned, Gamergate is using ethics in game journalism as a smokescreen, as a reason for trashing particular individuals. Mm-hmm. But in fact, they haven't really done anything meaningful to change the nature of game journalism. And in fact, I don't believe they can.
Yeah.
Simply because game journalism is an enthusiast press, and it's always going to be like that.
Mm-hmm. And this next question, I'm sure I already know the answer. I think you've probably already answered this a few minutes ago, but I just want to clarify for this talk. And that is the other rallying cry of the Gamergate movement. That is when they talk about the Gamers Are Dead article that Leah Alexander put up, in, I think, a few months since then, and about how they say, that she's attacking gamers, she's attacking the industry as a whole, blah, blah, blah. But I think I know what your answer is going to be, and that is that the term gamer really has grown. You mentioned a few minutes ago regarding casual market, and how as long as anyone is playing a video game, it doesn't matter what their age is, what their gender is, what their game is, they are considered consumers in this industry.
Yeah, absolutely. The interpretation that the Gamers Are Dead article was somehow an attack on gamers or an attack on the industry was, completely ill-informed. It did not come from actually reading the article carefully. It was just a knee-jerk response. And they felt threatened by what she was saying, which is that the hardcore gamer is in fact a dwindling percentage of the overall market. And that is absolutely true, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But by having a somewhat inflammatory headline that was bound to get hits, they, found a cause they could rally behind.
Mm-hmm.
And they could play the victim card and pretend that gamers are badly treated. And that Gama Sutra is being mean to them. And of course, it's absurd. It's just nonsense. So yeah, that doesn't really even deserve any further attention. They are annoyed at the fact that they are no longer the center of the game industry's world. That is, hardcore gamers are no longer the center of the game industry's world. And that's kind of too bad, but we tend to follow the money.
Yep, and a really good point. And that actually takes me to one of my last two questions regarding Gamergate and this topic. One thing that I do want to touch on, we've talked about this over this section with the hardcore market, and as you just said, Ernest, with the fact that it's not disappearing, it's just being overshadowed by the growing casual and more inclusive market. And I want to touch on another, I guess, quote-unquote, sticking point that the Gamergate group tends to bring up, and that is people trying to boycott or silence games that are aimed towards the hardcore crowd. This is another topic I'm sure that both of us will pretty much refute, but the big example of the last few months would be Hatred, that game that was showing pretty much a guy going on a genocidal murder spree. People were complaining that, the game press is silencing it, it's never going to get a fair share, blah, 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 again, that type of argument. And it's another one of those things that I'm pretty sure our thoughts are going to mirror, but let's hear what you have to say about it first.
Well, my attitude is that consumer boycotts are entirely reasonable regardless of what their origin is.
Mm-hmm.
So, the people who organize consumer boycotts against violent video games, against sexist video games, and so on. Mm-hmm. The people who were very concerned about the morality of video games that we saw, in the era of Jack Thompson and those kinds of activities. As far as I'm concerned, that sort of activity is entirely legitimate regardless of what reason you undertake it for.
Mm-hmm.
What is not legitimate is actually efforts to censor games. If you want to get out and tell other people, don't buy this game, I think this game is obnoxious and and immoral or objectionable in some fashion, that's totally okay with me.
Yeah.
What I object to is efforts to censor games and use the power of the law mm-hmm. to suppress our creative freedom in this context. So what's going on here is that people who like games that offend other people are claiming the special privilege of not being criticized. Mm-hmm. You know, they're saying it's not okay to criticize the games we like. And they're wrong. They're simply wrong. You know, if I think that a game is disgustingly violent and it, you know, promotes horrible activities and so on. I mean, you know, there was a little handmade, extremely cheapo shooter some years ago called Ethnic Cleansing, in which you ran around and shot Jews. And the point of the game, it was made by a white power outfit, and the point of the game was to kill all the Jews that you could. And I think it is entirely reasonable to say, you know, we really shouldn't promote this game. This is an unpleasant game, but I would never say it should be censored. Mm. So, what's happening is that, you know, people don't like the fact that some consumers are objecting to game content. And that's tough. It's, you know, it's the free marketplace of ideas. And I don't, you know, there are undoubtedly going to be people out there who will urge boycotts of games because they contain, say, gay characters. Mm-hmm. And that's okay too, as long as it doesn't turn into legal action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I agree with you definitely on that. I've been saying this for the last few months. I'm the same way. I believe the consumer has the right to boycott elements, but I don't believe in censorship. I think that goes down a very dark road. From my point of view, I say if a developer wants to make an incredibly misogynistic game, they want to make Dead or Alive Extreme Pillow Fight, for example, they are within their rights. I will support their right to make that game. But if people complain and say, you know, we don't want this type of game, we don't want to buy it, they lose the right to say, oh, you know, this is just a game. You can't complain about this. You know, we're just making this fun little thing. There needs to be accountability in what you're developing and how that is viewed from the market.
Yeah, absolutely. Freedom of expression does not relieve you of accountability. Yes. For what you say. You know, and if you make an obnoxious game, then, you know, you have the freedom and the right to do so. And other people have the freedom and the right to criticize you for doing it. You know, it does not mean that you are protected from criticism.
Yeah, and that is a point that we could spend, you know, an hour on, and how it relates to Gamergate and the whole deal. An example, you just mentioned the game Ethnic Cleansing. Someone was telling me there is a game someone released that it was on Early Access or Greenlay about someone killing gay people, and it was made, I think, by a very religious person. And he was talking about how, oh, people were going to be offended by it. I may be cause people were going to be offended and, you know, trying to rationalize it. You know, it's just a game or whatnot. And it's the same thing. If you want to make something that is that disgusting, that horrible, you are free to make that. No one should be allowed to stop you. But then when you release it and people go, oh my God, what the hell is wrong with you? I'm not going to buy this or look at any games you make. You can't just sit there, you know, shaking your head going, what did I do?
Right. Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Yep. So this has definitely been another fascinating conversation with you, Ernest. But I know you're very busy. You have to probably get going. And again, we could sit here not just talking about Gamergate, but talking about the game industry in general for the next 2-3 hours, probably more. But to wrap things up on Gamergate before we start talking about the end of this cast, do you have any final thoughts or topics you want to bring up either about Gamergate or about the industry becoming more inclusive to women?
Yes, I'd like to make one final point about that, and that is that for those of us who are in the industry, it is important that we continue to accentuate the positive. Mm-hmm. You know, it, it it becomes very easy to kind of get addicted to outrage and to become upset and angry and to keep passing around Facebook posts about how awful certain people have behaved and how unpleasant the game industry is and so on. That does not help solve the problem of increasing diversity in the game industry. Horror stories don't help. Mm-hmm. They actually they play into the hands of those who are responsible for the bad behavior in the first place. Repeating the news about them actually doesn't help the problem. So what I would like to encourage people to do is remember that the game industry is incredibly fun. It's incredibly interesting. It's fascinating. It's challenging. It's a wonderful opportunity to express yourself, to devise entertainment for people, to create a new art form. And we must not lose sight of the fact that this is one of the most exciting new media to come along in a very long time. And so, you know, if you are on the fence about getting into this industry, please definitely consider it. Try it. You know, ignore what you've heard about the horror stories. See what you can do about actually making a game. It's easier and easier thanks to middleware. You know, you can download a free copy of Unity and play around with it. And so, you know, don't let yourself be put off by all this negativity. And for those of us who are in the industry, please continue to accentuate the positive.
Yep, definitely a great statement to end the cast on us. And I hope something that a lot of people will listen to. All right. I was going to ask you, Ernest, if you have any final thoughts you would like to say for the cast in general, but I think those words were definitely more than enough as a final thoughts for this cast.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
Yep, Ernest, again, it has been a pleasure. We had like 2-3 more topics planned, but we just had such great conversations regarding game design, and then talking, at least giving some talk about Gamergate and those types of issues. But I said this a few minutes ago, we could really just sit here for the next 2-3 hours and just rattle off on so many great topics. And I really do hope that you'll have more free time, hopefully in the next few months. I would love to have you back on. I really would love to get you on one of our developer roundtable podcasts, because I think that would be a very illuminating conversation.
Well, thank you for the invitation. If I can make it fit into my schedule, I'll be happy to do so.
Awesome. All right. So for those of you listening, we are going to wrap things up for this episode of the Perceptive Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. As always, if you'd like to contribute to Game Wisdom, we have several options available. First, if you'd like to write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, you can find all the information and links under Submissions Wanted. To contribute to our Patreon campaign to secure some desperately needed monthly funding for the site to allow me to pay the bills, support the family, and keep producing great content like this, you can find me on Patreon using the Patreon banner on the front or searching for Josh Beister or Game Wisdom on Patreon.com. Any donations would be greatly appreciated because it will all add up hopefully in the end. And lastly, if you'd like to watch my daily streaming of games while talking about their design or just talking about the general thoughts of playing them, you can find me on Twitch under my channel of GW Beister. And all the recordings get uploaded to YouTube on the Game Wisdom page, which you can find by just searching for Game Wisdom. So, again, Ernest, I really do want to thank you for coming back on again. And as I said, I hope we can do this again real soon.
Thank you much.
And for those of you listening, thanks again. And I will talk to you again real soon. Take care, everybody.